Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Hope your day's off to a strong start. Coming up later on the program, we'll open up the phones, find out how seniors are graduating this year, college and high school. What are the ways that you've paid tribute to the grad in your life? That's coming up next hour on Air Talk here on KPCC. This hour, a little bit later, we'll talk about tension in Minneapolis, as you just heard on NPR News. Officials there concerned after last night's protest turned violent. We'll get a report on the scene from our sister broadcasting entity, Minnesota Public Radio, a little bit later this hour. But we begin with the latest on COVID-19. Joining us again, Dr. Dean Blumberg, Professor of Medicine and UC Davis Children's Hospital's Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases. Dr. Blumberg, thank you for joining us once again on Air Talk.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let's talk first about some of the positive news that we're seeing when it comes to hospitalizations and the death rate from COVID-19. As we just heard on NPR News, the overall death rate is staggering from COVID-19, but we are seeing some positive trends, aren't we?
We are. We're seeing decreasing number of daily deaths in the U.S. overall, and so we do have some positive trends.
Hospitals are continuing to hold up being able to handle the cases that come to them. As we're starting to see the economy reopen in California, with some areas, restaurants again are starting to provide indoor seating. We're seeing other events like worship services with smaller gatherings inside. To what degree should we be concerned about a resurgence of the coronavirus?
Well, with increased mobility and increased human interaction, there is more opportunity for new infections and enhanced transmission. So I think this is a concern. On the other hand, working in our favor is that we're entering summer, and so people will be outdoors more, and that'll reduce spread of the virus. And then in general, winter respiratory viruses take a pause during the summer, and so we can hope that that happens with this coronavirus, although we can't count on it.
Is there some evidence that there may be a seasonal aspect to COVID-19?
Well, we know that with other coronaviruses, there's definitely a seasonal aspect, and they are transmitted more in the fall and the winter. The unknown issue with COVID-19 is that since about 95% of the population remains susceptible to infection, whether we're going to get continuing transmission in the summer despite the change in conditions.
So I wanted to ask you about antibody testing. I just heard Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, in his daily news conference say that in the antibody testing they're doing in New York, it's about 20% the rate of exposure to the virus overall. In some lower income neighborhoods, that's as high as 40% for people exposed to COVID-19. How reliable are those antibody tests?
You know, the antibody tests that are out there now, it's kind of like the Wild West. They really haven't been tested well. They've been released under emergency use authorization by the FDA. And so we really don't know how accurate they are. For some of the tests, we have better ideas than other about the accuracy. So I would take numbers like that with a grain of salt. That being said, I would think that in New York, where we knew that there were many, many cases and deaths, that you will have a higher rate of infection compared to, for example, California or Los Angeles.
Yesterday, the Associated Press released a poll that a significant percentage of Californians would not take a coronavirus vaccination even once it's widely available. About 20% of respondents said that they wouldn't take it. Just about a third said they're not sure. They'd have to see once it's available whether they felt it was safe to take. Do you have concerns about the potential that even once we get a vaccine that can be widely distributed, it will be difficult to get to herd immunity?
Yeah, I think that it wasn't surprising to see those numbers, but yes, I agree. It's really a concern. And The issue is that some people appear to have their mind made up already, meaning, in my opinion, they're really closed-minded, that they just don't want the vaccine at all. You know, I would hope that people would have open minds and wait and see what the science shows and the data shows. But I think that's one of the issues with the vaccine, with the whole rush to have the vaccine be approved and used, is we need to have confidence in it. And the only way to gain confidence in a vaccine, something that we're planning on giving to we want to give to every healthy person in the U.S., is we need to be confident that this is a safe vaccine and that it's an effective vaccine. And the only way to get that confidence is to have scientific studies with large numbers of people. And when I'm talking large numbers, I mean, we're going to need tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 people studied for people to be confident that this is a safe and effective vaccine. And rushing it out there beforehand, I think it's not going to work. And as that poll shows, people are not going to have confidence and it won't have widespread use.
Chance for you to ask your questions of today's medical expert, part of our daily update on COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus. Today from UC Davis Children's Hospital, Dr. Dean Blumberg. He's professor of medicine and chief of pediatric infectious diseases. We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also ask your question on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, tweet at AirTalk, or post on the AirTalk Facebook page, 866-893-KPECC. This is a chance for you to ask questions of Dr. Blumberg about COVID-19 and our understanding of it. Next hour, we're going to talk about celebrating grads, high school and college graduates this year. Some have done virtual graduation celebrations on Zoom. Others have done drive-through graduation celebrations. And in fact, some school districts have allowed it. Others have banned the drive-through graduation practice. Dr. Blumberg, what are your thoughts about allowing for the sort of drive-by way of celebrating graduations?
I think if people find meaning in that sort of gathering, then I would encourage it. I think the driving by, if people can maintain that 6-foot distance, is going to be safe. And if they're going to find closure and meaning in that and find a good ceremony in that, then I would encourage that. You know, I've seen also some photos where everybody is gathered together, where you see 100 kids in one picture right next to each other. And that's just a recipe for disaster. It's going to lead to not only transmission within that group, but within those families, and then outside those families within the community. And that sort of behavior can result in deaths to the most vulnerable.
Next hour, we're also going to look at the reopening of Las Vegas. Next week, a number of the large resort hotels are going to be opening up their doors. There is not a mandatory masking requirement. It's recommended. All the employees apparently will be wearing face coverings, but not all of the guests on the casino floor or staying at those hotels. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's going to be a risk factor. So the number one thing that people can do to prevent transmission is the social distancing. That's more important than the masking. But if you're going to be indoors, and if you're going to be indoors, for example, in a casino, even if you limit capacity, you just know that some patrons are going to be walking within 6 feet of each other. And in that case, that's where the mask is of benefit. So that's the second most important thing that you can do to prevent infection, is to wear a mask when you can't social distance. I think that's a mistake. It's going to lead to more transmission. And again, when we talk about transmission, some people might think, well, I'm young and healthy, so if I get sick, it's no big deal. And that's likely true, but that's really a selfish view of the world and your community. And so any increased transmission can affect those who are most vulnerable within our communities.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital. He is one of our regular expert guests joining us on our daily COVID-19 update here on AirTalk on KPECC. Last time you were with us, I recall you saying you need a haircut, and boy, I sure do. Mm-hmm. I look pretty unkempt, but there aren't many people seeing me. That's the upsides. I'm pretty well locked down. what are your thoughts about barbershops and hair salons reopening, provided that customers and the stylists cover their faces?
Yeah, so if the stylist covers their face and the customer covers their face with a mask, and of course for a haircut, to make that practical, you don't want one of the masks that ties in the back, because that's going to be on top of your hair. You'd want one that has the ear loops. I think that there's still a risk for that interaction, but it's a low risk. And so people need to weigh the practicality of not getting a haircut versus taking that small risk. In addition, it's recommended not to have common waiting areas. So come in exactly at the time of your appointment. Don't sit next to each other in a waiting area. Maintain social distancing within the salon. And then, obviously, plenty of hand sanitizer.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We've talked repeatedly about the vulnerability of nursing home residents, assisted living residents, and those who work at those facilities. The institutional facilities are the ones that have been hardest hit. Prisons, of course, jails as well, have had a very serious problem with it. The state of California has issued new instructions to all skilled nursing facilities that everybody needs to be tested in that facility. Now, this goes beyond what LA County authorities had said. So in California, even if skilled nursing facilities show no cases of COVID-19, the facility must continue to test 25% of residents and its employees on a weekly basis to ensure that all staff members are tested at least once a month. Doctor, what do you think about those state obligations for skilled nursing facilities?
Yeah, so that's a more aggressive stance than the CDC currently has. But you have to realize that nationwide, over 40% of the deaths in the U.S. have been among residents of nursing homes, and it's about 25% of deaths in California. These are our most vulnerable members of our community. They're commonly older, and so that's a risk factor. And then many of them have significant comorbidities, such as hypertension, obesity, or lung disease. And they're in relatively crowded living conditions. So once you get one case in a nursing home or skilled nursing facility, that can go through that facility like wildfire and really just kill many of the residents. So I think that's why the state is really bending over backwards to assure that these environments are safe. Many of us have loved ones that live in these environments, and we really care and worry about them. So we do want to make sure that they're safe.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, to share with us any questions that you have for Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, 866-893-5722. Tweet at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. One of the big questions as people start going back to work is whether there should be routine COVID-19 testing at the workplace, whether employers should be providing it and or demanding it of employees. Should there be checks of temperature as employees come to work? What do you think would be the most effective way to try and keep workplaces from becoming centers for outbreaks?
The most effective things that workplaces can do is to maintain an environment that allows for adequate social distancing. So that may result in, making every other cubicle occupied and leaving some of those empty so that people aren't crowded together. Making sure that there's plenty of hand sanitizer available, and then having a culture at work that emphasizes that if people are sick, they need to stay home, and that they shouldn't come in and just tough it out, as sometimes workplaces really value that, people coming into work when they're sick. But in this environment, we just can't afford that kind of an attitude. So having generous leave policies, so if people are sick, they do stay home. The temperature screening, I think, is low yield. It's really not worth the effort. effort. If people aren't feeling well, if people have a fever, they should just stay home. It's very rare that when you screen people who are feeling well and they're coming to work, that you'll just pick up a random fever. So I think that's low yield in terms of effort.
Silas asks, what about air conditioning or indoor fans? Are they likely to spread COVID-19 from person to person?
Yeah, you know, there's no evidence that air conditioners result in increased risk of infection or transmission. Most office buildings will have ventilation systems that have filters in them. Some of these filters are so small, the size of the filters are so small that they can actually screen out the virus.
We have Jerry in Huntington Beach. A similar question, but about people entering businesses or casinos, customers coming through the door. Since checking temperature is largely a waste of time, are there any other screening measures that you'd recommend?
Well, it would be worthwhile to ask people if they're sick or have plenty of signage up. If they're not feeling well, ask them to please not come. We know that some people are so motivated to do things that they'll try to convince themselves otherwise that they're feeling well. They might have had planned an outing to the casino far in advance and have the time off. And if they're feeling sick, they might just think, I'm looking forward to this that I'm going to go anyway. So having the signage up or screening for illness is useful. And then also if the management sees anybody that's sick that appears to be ill, to really approach them in a non-confrontational manner and try to convince them that they shouldn't be there.
We'll continue our conversation with UC Davis Children's Hospital physician Dr. Dean Blumberg. And we have more listener questions for Dr. Blumberg. It's our daily update on the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. 866-893-KPECC. Coming up a little bit later this hour, we'll get the very latest from Minneapolis, where a second night of protests turned violent with arson and rioting. We'll talk about what authorities have said there. They just held a news conference. We'll be back momentarily on Air Talk. Coming up later this hour on Air Talk, we'll take a look at an executive order that President Trump said he's going to issue, which would remove significant legal protection that social media companies now enjoy. We'll talk about whether it's likely the president will do this and what sort of legal challenge would likely be forthcoming. That's later this hour. We'll also talk about Twitter's decision to label a tweet of the president's about what large-scale vote by mail fraud would potentially be like. Joining us right now, Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital. We have a question from Carrie in Pasadena. I belong to a bike club. We want to resume activity. We're wondering what risk of exposure we have biking in a tight group and whether this has been studied.
I'm not aware of any studies. The positive thing about biking is you're outside, and so the air is being diluted. But if you're in a tight group for a prolonged period of time, that will increase. That's just like standing next to somebody, and that's going to increase your risk of transmission. So if you're within 3 feet or 6 feet of somebody and you're riding for 20 minutes or an hour, that's a risk of transmission. So I would recommend that if you can, try to ride and not in a tight group, or if possible, you could wear masks. I know most people don't want to wear masks if they're doing an aerobic activity because that makes it more difficult to breathe. But then the alternative is social distancing.
All right. Let's see. We have Kerry in Silver Lake. He wonders, how safe is it to stay in a hotel or motel?
Yeah, so staying in a hotel or a motel room is, I think, is generally safe. The air is going to be safe because you're not going to be in the room with somebody with the staff of the hotel. The main risk would be from contact transmission. So if the room's not adequately cleaned, and we specifically are concerned with high-touch surfaces, things like the door handles, the TV remote control, in the bathroom, the sink and toilet handles, those sorts of things. But even so, even with those high-touch surfaces, the risk of transmission is relatively low. It's believed that more than 90% of transmission of COVID-19 cases are via the respiratory route and not from contact. So that's why the big emphasis is on social distancing, and being in a hotel room by yourself or with a family member is not going to increase your risk of getting infected.
BB Steve brings up about spread through air conditioning. The story that we all heard about, gosh, I guess it was a month or so ago, where in China, a group of people eating at a restaurant, that the virus supposedly infected people through that air conditioning system. Was that anecdotal account, did that end up being debunked, or what? I can't remember what came from that.
Yeah, it didn't end up being debunked, but it was vigorously debated. And so far, that's the only study that I've seen that have suggested that there's transmission by air conditioning. There's been no other studies that have suggested that. And the other issue is that in that particular restaurant, that particular report, there was very poor ventilation in there. People were very crowded together. And so the transmission wasn't necessarily from the air conditioning itself, but it was from crowded conditions, people being indoors. Remember that in China, they've done some excellent studies looking at transmission. And when they've looked at outbreaks involving three or more people, these transmission events, they found that none of these were reported from people who were outdoors, and all of those outbreaks were reported from indoor transmission. Again, being indoors, it's a confined space with limited volume of air, and so the virus isn't diluted as much as if you're outdoors, where there's basically an infinite amount of air to dilute the virus.
Susan in Oak Park, you're on Air Talk with Dr. Dean Blumberg.
Hi, I was wondering if I had housekeepers come to my house, they wore masks and gloves, and we were not present, how much of a risk is that?
Yeah, so I don't think that that's much of a risk. And in fact, if you trust your housekeepers and cleaners, obviously they should leave your house cleaner than when they came in. So they're wearing masks, so they're not breathing it into the air. And even if they weren't wearing a mask when you weren't there, there would be very low risk of transmission, because the virus does not remain in the air for a very long time. It usually, as we've talked about before, it's usually the droplets that transmit and gravity takes over. They end up on the ground. And then so they're cleaning. And so the risk would be is if they're not doing a good job cleaning and if they're actually contaminating surfaces. And, you know, if you trust your cleaners to do a good job, then there should be no risk to you.
All right, Susan, thanks very much. Bill in Long Beach wonders, is eye exposure a likely route of transmission for the virus?
Yeah, eye exposure certainly is a route of transmission. Any mucous membrane, so eyes, nose, and mouth, is where the virus can enter, and it can enter directly via somebody coughing and having some droplets, or speaking loudly or singing can end up in your eye, or if you touch something and then you rub your eye, that's another way that the virus can be transmitted.
EGW writes on the page, are we trying not to overrun hospitals, or are we trying to eliminate COVID completely? Very different approaches. I think what he's speaking to is that it seemed like we've had kind of a moving target with public health officials. Originally, the stay-at-home order was billed as largely about keeping hospitals from being overrun so that everybody who ultimately got sick from the coronavirus would be able to be treated. There'd be enough ventilators, there'd be enough medical staff and rooms to care for them. It seemed like then over time the idea was, well, we want to keep the death rate down, and that the more we can keep people locked down, the fewer people will die. Can you elaborate a bit on the strategy here?
Yeah, so initially, for example, in February in the U.S., I think the idea was, let's hope we can eliminate transmission by very aggressively screening travelers and looking at any contacts of people who were diagnosed. And, you know, obviously that didn't work. So now we're in the mitigation phase, where we just want to decrease the number of infections. I don't think anybody thinks that we can eliminate transmission at this point. there's a couple reasons for that. One is that there's too much community transmission that's occurring. Many cases cause mild disease or asymptomatic infection, and so those are going to be very difficult to detect. And this is different, for example, than SARS-1 the first time around in 2002-2003. You know, that infection, people were most infectious starting from when they became symptomatic up to about day 5 of illness. With COVID-19, people are most infectious before they become ill, and then by 5 days they're into the illness, they're generally asymptomatic. So it's really a different risks in terms of transmissibility, and it's going to make it that much more difficult to control. So it's really limiting infections right now. We're not going to eliminate transmission.
Dr. Blumberg, I want to thank you so much for being with us yet again, providing your expertise. Thank you for the generosity of your time and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you, and stay safe.
All right, we will. Dr. Dean Blumberg, UC Davis Children's Hospital, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases.